This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Interfaith Action Network held a community meeting on Sunday in the Miller neighborhood of Gary to tell citizens more about what are called mobile mental health teams, which can supplement the work of police officers either by answering nonviolent calls independently or working alongside them to access and de-escalate situations. Mary Stewart Pellegrini is one of the members of the steering committee that set up yesterday afternoon's meeting at the complex of the St. Mary of the Lake Catholic Church. We spoke with her before the event about the issue and how the city of Gary can better respond to those types of calls. Mary, explain the group that is interested in approaching the city and asking for the city's help in exploring, among other things, the idea of the mobile mental health teams.
Oh, yes, I'm very glad to. Our group is called the Indiana Interfaith Action Network, and we're composed of 9 churches in the Lake County and Porter County area. I'm on a steering committee of 7 people, and then we have a larger community involvement from the respective churches that are engaged. And what we're really interested in is getting money set aside from the American Rescue Plan to facilitate a mobile mental health care unit, which we think is not only direly in need. There are models for it throughout the state of Indiana and South Bend and Indianapolis and also in Chicago to distinguish between mental health issues and issues, to not criminalize mental health issues. That's right. What I want to say.
Right. Mm-hmm. What seem to be the important things that citizens should know about the problem that is going on and how the mental and mobile health teams can actually help, if not resolving completely, but at least to certainly abating the problem?
Well, mental health, as you know, Chris, is a major issue across the country. We're not an anomaly with regards to that. Homelessness and challenges associated with the COVID crisis have exacerbated those issues. And so oftentimes people are in crisis and they will call the police, and the police will often come and support them in whatever way they can. We, however, also feel that it's a lot for the police to have to do, given the volume and the increase in mental health crisis that we're experiencing, not only in the state, but around the country. And so a mobile mental health unit would provide certified staff, social workers, who are trained in a mental health crisis. The police also, I understand, have received training in mental health crisis issues, how to address those. But the focus would be more on making certain there's a professional who's concerned about these issues and have familiar with how to address them, for the police to call, or to go with the police, or for the staff to call, individuals who are in crisis to call to help them, and then direct them where they might get the most viable help.
Where has it worked well, or at least so far, since they've been in place? Where have these mobile mental health teams been working well since they've been established?
Yes. Well, certainly in South Bend. Last year, they instituted or brought to fruition their own mobile mental health unit program, and it's very successful. In fact, we went up to visit them when they were going through the process of gaining community involvement and community trust and interacting with individuals who are concerned about these issues. In Indianapolis, there are mobile mental health units, and also in Chicago. We have done research in terms of what's available across the country regarding mobile mental health care and its partnership with mental health professionals and its support in terms of the police. We're not suggesting that mental health units be located in the police department, but rather there be a partnership. So if there's a crisis, then what we found, what happens around the country, then a mobile mental health person can accompany the police who are referring to a specific issue, are in fact, in some places, the individuals can call directly.
Maybe perhaps like an organization like Geminis or maybe one of the healthcare systems in the region that might help out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is the proposal that that your group all together, including the Interfaith and all the other organizations that are joining together on this, what is the proposal that you're making to the city of Gary to be able to move towards setting up these mobile mental health teams?
Well, we've provided them with the information that I think we've shared through we now have a website, Interfaith Action Network, where the mayor's office and others can provide, get additional information. But the proposal looks at the proliferation of mental health issues, how much funding is available. We're really asking for, I think, $1.5 million in funding to get a pilot started and to get it established in the what I call the budget. So as we move forward, that money would continuously be available. But we're looking to get started in doing that.
What seems to be the at least the feeling so far from city government as to the idea and maybe setting some funds aside for it?
Well, I think the mayor has been supportive, certainly in terms of engaging the police department in supporting outreach for mental health. We've had conversations with the Common Council, and Mr. Councilman Chairperson Godwin and others of his organization have been supportive. We've also met with Sheriff Martinez and looked at, they have a very progressive program, the Lake County Sheriff's Office. And so in Gary proper, I think we're having increasing support. The more people know and understand the importance of having a resource for people who have mental health crisis, and they understand the breadth and depth of mental health crisis, what's included in those, I think the greater the support is.
Now, I imagine that obviously getting the word out, as you mentioned, is an important part of it. That's why this community meeting on Sunday was being held there in the Miller neighborhood of Gary, to be able to explain to citizens, to hear from citizens about this.
Absolutely.
Tell us about some of the speakers who are asked to show up for the event.
Well, we have invited three speakers who have experienced mental health challenges, who are going to tell their personal stories. One of those individuals is Rebecca Wyatt, who was a local politician and lawyer here, and then two other individuals who've had specific experience recently with mental health crises. Those will be speakers. And then we're going to be having individuals from the Interfaith Action Committee group itself talk about what our purposes, our goals, what we've done, and what we've accomplished to date.
What kind of reaction, at least finding out initial reaction from the community for this idea? Have you had some pros and maybe some folks that are not familiar enough to know what it's all about?
That's a great question. I think we had very positive response from the community and also the request for greater information. And so part of the reason for having this town hall meeting, our community meeting, is to answer people's questions about what's really involved in mental health crises. I mean, if you've never had one in your family, you may not understand what it is. That's the importance for having people who have lived that experience talk today. And so I would say this is a part of our effort to continue to inform the community about what's involved, to encourage them to talk to their district representatives, council people, their legislatures also, to advocate for the kind of changes that we're talking about.
Now, obviously, you would hope that you could have the mobile mental health team set up yesterday. That's not likely, of course.
Right.
But how soon do you hope that if the city cooperates and gets the funds available and you're able to get things moving, that you'll be able to get the pilot program that you mentioned going?
Well, I know as soon as possible is probably not a very definitive answer, but that's the best answer I can provide at the moment, because it's very important to stay in dialogue with the mayor's office and the Common Council who makes these decisions to look at where the funds are going across the state. We know there's a substantial amount of American Rescue Plan's money coming here. It would be wonderful if we could get it up in a year and a half, maybe two, or if not sooner.
Obviously, the sooner the better, because the problem is not going to get worse or get any better, I would imagine.
No, the problem is escalating, in fact. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What have you learned in talking with police and in turn with maybe some members of the Commission on Police Reform as you were getting things together for the meeting?
Well, one of the things we've learned is that they want to stay in the conversation. Mm-hmm. They want concrete proposals, which we've been working on. They want us to understand what it means to partner. And to what it means also for us to have, a community of nine churches who are engaged in the process. So they also want us to do our due diligence and to come to understand what it means to make this kind of request, to understand the budgeting process and the behind-the-scenes efforts that are associated with allocating money in the city, which has lots of issues before it.
Mary Stuart Pellegrini is one of the steering committee members for the organization, which is sponsored by a number of groups, primarily the Interfaith Action Network and other organizations that are encouraging the city of Gary to help start a pilot program, as it apparently has worked well in other cities here in Indiana and elsewhere, Chicago, for example, for a mobile mental health team that in turn will help respond for some cases as they get called out by 911 rather than send the police to look into these. And thank you very much for explaining what's been going on and what's going to be going on in the future, and we hope that we hear more from you soon.
People should know that they are available to go to our website page, the Interfaith Action Network webpage, and find out more about that. There's really numbers there as well, a website there, and we'll be able to get back to them and answer any question they have. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share what we're talking about here in the Interfaith Action Committee's efforts to move forward a mobile mental health initiative.
Mobile mental health units were part of the Gary Police Reform Commission's recommendations to city officials. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing our conversations during this month of May, which is National Mental Health Awareness Month, the topic today is what employers can do to help support their employees to better care for their mental health. And that is, of course, because we're finding more and more employees are able to go back into the office or back into their workplace as the pandemic lessens. With us to talk about it, we have Chandra Lyles. She's a licensed clinical social worker and also the manager of psychiatric social services for Community Healthcare Systems Behavioral Health Services. And thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first let's find out, since we seem to be hearing in story after story on NPR about the Great Resignation, or whatever it happens to be called officially, and how the stress of those unsettling times seems to have pushed through this concern about an employer who quits because they're burned out, they feel stressed, they feel isolated, and that in turn triggers a wave of resignations. Do you believe that this crisis has sounded an alarm like this and has caused employers maybe to take a better look on how to better care for their employees' mental health?
Yes. I believe during this crisis, healthcare workers were at the center of all and the first to respond to patients in need. They not only had to deal with those coming in ill and dealing with their symptoms from physical ailments, but also they dealt with the emotional outpour of those coming in because they had lost loved ones suddenly due to the pandemic. With that being said, managers, you know, would benefit from ensuring that staff are aware that there are services out there if they need them through the EAP that's available. And also managers have looked at more ways to be compassionate in their approach to the struggles that the staff have faced during these times. I know personally, while at some of our sister hospitals, I would have conversations with nursing staff that seems to be very overwhelmed and challenged with all of the new complexities during the pandemic. And just to encourage them and praise them for what they're doing and letting them know that their work really matters and they make a difference, they really do seem to appreciate that.
In a recently published article, you had a chance to talk about the increased demand for mental health treatment, and increased since the pandemic really came about. How has poor mental health seemed to have an impact on productivity in the workplace?
Well, since the pandemic, it has had a great impact because when you look at everything altogether, since the onset of the pandemic, mental health has become more prevalent for a few reasons. There are a lot of children that have experienced isolation with the limited amount of engagement they have with friends and outside activities, which not only took a toll on them, but also, you know, for their parents. And the parents are the ones, you know, that are working. However, they're also facing those challenges of learning and navigating the e-learning systems with their children, which add extra pressure to adults. When it comes to that aspect, as opposed to maintaining their job. What we found is because of this, a lot of people started to suffer due to the isolation and lack of socialization and not being able to vacation and just getting out doing things. So in the workplace as well as home, you see more people are depressed. Mm-hmm. And so when you have people who are in a work environment and they have all these other outside stressors and they're suffering with some depression, this is going to severely impact their productivity. Also, you're having more call-offs. It affects their ability to function cognitively to their normal standard. So depression can, you know, cause and lead to lack of concentration, motivation, decreased energy, increased irritability, and also affect sleep and appetite, which all will impact the way someone is able to, you know, conduct their day-to-day work life.
Now, as a clinician, how could employers here in the region be able to invest in the overall mental health of an employee that will also happen to benefit the financial health of the organization?
By understanding that mental health is an important part of overall health, this can set the stage for for success for both employers and employees. One way to invest is through training managers to understand the signs and symptoms related to mental health and substance abuse. Because oftentimes when people become depressed or are having difficulties, they will start to self-medicate, sometimes with alcohol, sometimes with other, you know, type drugs. Another option is to conduct quarterly surveys geared toward employee health and job stress. This can be used to as a guide to know where and what additional services may be beneficial or needed to support staff. Mm-hmm. Also encouraging staff to utilize the EAP services and ensure that employees are aware that that information is confidential, because this is one of the reasons a lot of people do not want to participate, because they feel like if they're getting treatment for mental health, it's going to impact or affect their job. And just when employees are happy and feel supported, they usually become more proactive and productive, and this will benefit the health of the organization financially.
We're speaking with Chandra Lyles. She is a licensed clinical social worker, and she's also the manager of psychiatric social services for the Community Healthcare Systems Behavioral Health Services. And I know that it's come up often, I'm sure, in discussions, and it's more common, I suppose, maybe to many that do a constant look at mental health issues. But disabilities sometimes are invisible, or a lot of them are, I would imagine, and have the stigma that are attached to them. And even though I know that we have the Americans with Disabilities Act in place, there is a lot of shame and stigma that's attached to trying to look for help for any kind of mental health condition. What can region employers do to be able to break down these barriers to mental health care and treatment if necessary?
Chris, I feel that the one good thing that has come out of the pandemic is the increased awareness about mental health, mm-hmm. and more of an acceptance of mental health. It has also become kind of normalized that because of it, that we all have a breaking point. I think that the more we talk about mental health and become comfortable having those conversations, people are more willing to seek services and help and treatment for the mental health that their issues they may be experiencing. What has also changed since the pandemic is the accessibility to services that were not available before the pandemic. Such as telehealth and in-home services, which allow people to receive services in the comfort and privacy of their own homes. What we have done as a hospital system was to put together a resource for suicide prevention guide that details crisis hotlines, inpatient, outpatient treatment facilities, veteran information, substance abuse programs, and the crisis text information, as well as warning signs for suicide, all in one guide. So that way, whenever, you know, someone enters the hospital or someone may suspect that this person is in a crisis, this is something that can be given to them as a guide, or even if they know someone, you know, all the resources are right there laid out for them.
I was looking at an example here about an employee in Kentucky about filing a suit because he got a surprise birthday celebration and he had asked not to have one because he was afraid it would trigger his anxieties. Is that a possibility that they could face in the workplace? And maybe it is something that employers could possibly help try to avoid, and certainly to be able to destigmatize mental health issues at work.
That's a very good example because I actually know someone, and it's kind of the same scenario. Like they suffer with anxiety, actually, and it was the same situation exactly. They really did not want us to make a big deal about their birthday or anything like that. However, because I work in the mental health field, you know, I kind of picked up on the cues of, you know, and knowing the reason and why. So I think sometimes we just have to be very cautious and think about what we're doing when it comes to other people, because most definitely you don't want to make someone feel uncomfortable, and if that's something that's going to trigger something for someone, you most definitely want to avoid that. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to situations like that, I mean, maybe that was a situation that could not really be avoided, especially if that person was able to manage their mental health well, and people just didn't realize, because like you said initially, some disabilities are invisible. And when people are able to manage their mental health, you know, well, it's very hard to determine if they have those type of disabilities. So I think just being, you know, having, like I said, those open conversations and trying to debunk the stigma of mental health is going to help a lot. If we can have more open conversations and make people feel like it's okay to come, you know, to you to talk to them if they're having problems or if they're going through something without being judged, is going to be very helpful.
Chantra Lyles is a licensed clinical social worker, and she's the manager of psychiatric social services for Community Healthcare Systems and Behavioral Health Services. And Chantra, thank you very much for the great insight, and we appreciate hearing from you. And as we continue on with National Mental Health Awareness Month, it's something that we should perhaps keep in mind. And if we happen to have the opportunity, because of what we do, to be able to support workers, our colleagues, maybe for their mental health issues if they have them. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. St. Joseph's College is moving ahead into the future after having some tough times for a while, but they're back in business, quite literally and figuratively speaking. And we're going to find out more on how St. Joseph's College, or to the alums and others, call St. Joe. We're talking with Dr. Chad Pulver. He is the chancellor at the college. And Chancellor Pulver, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Absolutely, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with you, we should probably preface our next remarks with the fact that you're an alum and you came back to campus. Will you tell us more about yourself, about your education, and what in particular drew you to come back to St. Joseph's College?
I graduated in the 90s, and then I met my wife there, and we both went on and did our graduate work. I actually earned a master's at Purdue University and then a PhD from Purdue as well, and then went and worked for a year for the University of Kansas. And then in 2004, came back and was a faculty member at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer, and stayed there and worked until the closure in 2017, and had gone up through the ranks a little bit, received tenure, and actually was a department chair, and then actually was the vice president when we closed in 2017. And so I stayed on to try to help with some of the transition with the closure. And then in 2018, I've had a private practice since 2006. And in 18, I went into full-time practice with that as a psychologist. And so started to have conversations in the last fall, so fall of 21, and they started to ask about some of the ideas that we might be able to have a more local growth here, a community-based approach to what we were doing with St. Joseph's College in our rural areas. And so that was a very strong interest for me. My family has chosen to stay in Jasper County. We came here in the 2000s, and so have grown our family and have children in the educational system, and so it's very important for us to be able to try to make our area stronger. And so we came back, and I came back to St. Joe and have worked here since January to try to turn things around and get things stronger.
Well, you mentioned about having the opportunity through your work as the chancellor now to be able to, as you say, turn things around. How bad was the situation at one point up to the closing of the campus here a few years ago?
It was financially very difficult. We had some technology issues, we had some financial issues, and they had been going on for a long time. It wasn't just one or two years. We're talking about decades worth of different things that were happening financially. And St. Joe was lucky enough at times to get some gifts, to be able to get some endowment entries, and were able to navigate a number of those rocky waters for a while. But it certainly caught up to us in 2017, to where some of the requirements that we needed were not in good position. And so the decision in 2017 had more to do with being able to make sure that our students had an opportunity to further their education without showing up to class and the locks are on the doors and they have nowhere else to go. And so very difficult decision, to say the least, but the idea was can we find a way for our students to continue their education and then be able to put an earmark and hope that we have a chance to come back in the future. And so that's what we're working on right now.
Mm-hmm. What ways have you found to be able to bring students to that point where they can get their degree from St. Joseph College?
Well, we have shifted to certification and skills growing. So that's where we are right now. We are not accredited, for example, where we were in 2017. And so we're not offering associate's level. We're not offering bachelor's level education right now. We're partnering with other institutions and trying to find options. We're thinking along the lines of trying to be a broker for education at this point. If we know there's a need, we are reaching out to other institutions and trying to find a way for them to offer their programs here. And so right now we have a degree that's actually in cybersecurity that's being offered on our campus right now. And so that is offered through another institution, but it is a fully accredited. They can get their associate's level and even move up to their bachelor's level. And so that's one of the ways that we're doing it locally, what we're trying to do. And students that come to our campus every day, we're offering a number of different health science certificates. So we've already had 121 graduates that have already gone through the program. We started these up in June of 2020 and have slowly started to grow the enrollment, started to grow what's going on. We've found that 85% of the people that have gone through our certifications have found employment afterwards. They're many of them are receiving scholarships, whether it's through Work One or Next Level Jobs. And so we're trying to make sure that the needs that we have locally are being met through the skills that we're trying to find for our students, and then they can walk into better living, better wages, better opportunities. We found that some students, once they get a flavor for that skill development, come and take multiple certifications. Or we've had students who have been enrolled in other institutions and they have a break, for example, a summer off, and so they came and fulfilled one of their certifications so they could go back and be employed while they're on another campus. And it helped them with their education, it helped them with their employment. So we're trying to be able to solve the issues that people in our community have.
Did working with the folks at the Center of Workforce Innovations help in kind of creating this shift into what St. Joseph's College has become, certainly? Kind of moving away from just the liberal arts college of the past and looking to the future and to helping people find work and good jobs in the future?
Absolutely. What we're trying to do is we're looking for partners. We're looking for corporations. We're looking for employers who know they have an issue they're trying to solve. And so when we are having conversations with corporations, with entities, with employers, when we hear what we might be able to do with them, we're trying to invite them to be part of the process earlier. It is not a secret that in the state of Indiana, we have a worker shortage. We're feeling that we have a number of openings and very few people that are filling those. And so if we find that an employer has that need and we can invite them to be part of that process earlier, it's easy just to hire the person when they're finished with the program. I think most employers want to hire people. The issue that we're looking for is, can we get those employers involved earlier? Can we get them to be part of the educational process? Can we build the program to be more specific to what is going to be a successful employee for them, as well as an easy transition for them to be able to hire and retain that student? So those are the things that I've been working on diligently since I've been in this role in January, is finding those partners, trying to find what we can do with the educational construction, so that way when we build that skill set, those students are not only successfully employed, but they are retained and that employer feels satisfied and they're able to grow their business, which is what every community needs.
We're speaking with Dr. Chad Pulver, who is Chancellor of St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer. He's taken over the leadership of the college and helping the college move on into the 21st century further with some changes made. Dr. Pulver, will you bring us up to date on how the fall semester classes, or even, I guess, starting even sooner, are going to shape up here? I understand there's a new program that is going to get underway here at the end of May that will help probably offer some opportunities for education and for jobs in the future for some folks.
Well, we do have two that are coming up right now. We have the dispatcher, so emergency communications technologist, which we're trying to get up and rolling right now. We've had it approved. It's ready to go. We're enrolling students as it is right now. We also have the medical assistant that's up and running, and so we'll have courses that are running all summer long. And then in a traditional fall sense, we'll have the cybersecurity, which is associate's level degree that would be offered through our campus as well. And then we have other health, phlebotomy, we have the nursing assistants. So we have ongoing certifications that are running right now on our campus. If someone would like to see what they are, stjoe.edu, they can go. They can take a look at the different programs that are there. We outline how they might be able to get some support for scholarships. They outline whether it's a 10-week course, a 16-week course, how many days a week it would meet. And so we're trying to make sure that what we're doing, whether it is a rolling process, whether we know we're going to offer it once a year, we're trying to make sure that the things that we are putting in front of our students are something that will get them to where they need to go, help them set their plans, and help them get the successful completion of that certificate.
Now, how's the response been by not only people who want to become students, but the general public, in particular, residents around Rensselaer, to some of the changes and the rebranding, I guess, in a way, of St. Joseph's College?
The experiences that we've had have been very positive. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, those who are in Jasper County, those of us that live around us, they want solutions. They want solutions for their family. They want solutions for their children, whatever it might be. And so they're looking for deliverables, just as employers are. When we look at our role in the community, we want to be part of a solution. And so if we know what sort of questions are coming forward or problems that are happening, if we can be part of that conversation and even be support for the solution for that, that's what we're trying to do. And so in that way, I think it's been very positive. We just this last week, for example, had a continuing education for municipalities for wastewater management. The Indiana Alliance for Rural Water came in and provided a class. And so in our area, we're trying to build an educational oasis. And so where we are rural and 45 minutes north and 45 minutes south, there's wonderful institutions, but that's difficult sometimes for our populace to get to those areas on a regular basis for classes. And so we're trying to provide that oasis here. We're trying to find a way to get our population to be able to come here, get what they need, and further themselves.
Does it seem to be almost an advantage for St. Joseph's College to be where you are out here in the middle between West Lafayette and Northwest Indiana?
Well, I think so. I think that we're leaning into that idea that we're rural. I think for a lot of places where the populace is lower, I think sometimes there's this want a bigger population or want to have more things there. And I have embraced the idea that we don't have a large population. And so because of that, we have to do something different. We have to embrace where we are. And I think that's part of the stance that we've taken, which is we're not suddenly going to go from 33,000 people in Jasper County, or if you take Jasper and Newton County combined, 45,000 people. That's not going to explode to double or triple that in the next couple years. We have to embrace where we are. And so that's part of what we've tried to do, is that if this is who we are and this is where we are, then we need to find a way to be successful within that framework and to have some pride in that, and then invite the people that want to be a part of that to help us grow and help us do something different, because I think that success can allow for our agricultural communities, our small town businesses, our small business owners to be able to be successful and to be able to keep our communities vibrant and alive.
Well, Dr. Pulver, it sounds like, based on comments on the website talking about bringing St. Joseph's College to become a model Catholic liberal arts institution for the 21st century, seems like you're well on your way, and we're glad to hear about the news. Thank you very much for spending time talking about St. Joseph's College with us today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Dr. Chad Pulver is the chancellor of St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. On tomorrow's program, we'll find out the latest on gasoline prices, not only here in the region, but across the state and even the nation. We'll find out more from GasBuddy.com about that. We hope you can join us.